And On the Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On the Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On the Go. This podcast will focus on advanced care planning in the post-acute and long-term care setting. While advanced care planning, or ACP, has been a topic of attention for the past few years, it is by no means a new concept in medicine. Dr. William Osler, one of the founders of Johns Hopkins and creator of the first residency program for physician specialty training, could have been referring to advanced care planning when he said, "The good physician treats the disease. The great physician treats the patient who has the disease. Understanding our patients' goals and wishes, their values, regardless of their health status, appreciating who would make decisions for them should they not be able, and helping them to understand the implications of serious illness and options for care that they would want not only defines ACP, but also describes aspects of communication and education that would come from a great physician." Yet, in a May 2018 Journal of the American Geriatric Society article entitled "Physician Views on Advanced Care Planning and End-of-Life Care Conversations," one could ask whether medicine still supports Osler's notion of the great physician. As the study found that while the vast majority of providers thought that advanced care planning was very or extremely important, nearly 70% reported having no training to have such conversations. Over 50% found that the discussions were more challenging than rewarding. And in a separate survey, less than 20% of patients reported having advanced care planning discussions with their providers at all. 15 years ago, geriatrician and educator Muriel Gillick wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine Perspectives piece on advanced care planning, "If physicians take seriously their obligation to engage patients in decisions about their health care, they will initiate discussions of goals and preferences before a crisis develops." Why is advanced care planning such an obstacle to overcome in medicine today? Is it because of time? Are there just too many other things to do simultaneously for a provider? Is it a lack of a relationship with patients that practitioners used to have and cherish? Are there solutions to making ACP a natural and practical component of medical care? Well, I can think of no one more appropriate to help us navigate through the current complexity of advanced care planning than a national leader, lecturer, and advocate for patient wishes, end-of-life care, and public policy than Dr. Carl Steinberg. And we are privileged to have Dr. Steinberg return to AMDA On the Go. Dr. Steinberg is past chair for the Society of Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine Public Policy Committee and is soon to be editor-in-chief emeritus of its monthly news magazine, Caring for the Ages. In March of 2019, he was elected to be vice president of the society. He received his undergraduate degree from Harvard and his medical degree from The Ohio State University. He serves on the National Pulsed Program and the National Quality Forum Standing Committee on Geriatrics and Palliative Care. Dr. Steinberg has been a nursing home and hospice medical director in the San Diego, California area since 1995 and is known for regularly including his dogs with him on rounds. Dr. Steinberg, welcome back to AMDA On the Go.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Steinberg, as you know, I typically like to start our conversations with somewhat of a historical perspective. It seems that the support trial from the mid-1990s helped us to understand where we were falling short with our patients, and it was basically in our ability to communicate with them as providers. Tell us about the recent evolution of advanced care planning and why it continues to be a focus of discussion. Have we gotten any better in understanding our patients' goals and wishes? Are practitioners learning to partner with their patients in providing care better today? Has ACP become a truly viable way of increasing value in patient care? Or are we in the state of Muriel Gillick's crisis now?
That's a lot of questions there, but I'd say the short answer to those questions is basically yes. There's no doubt that a lot of progress has been made in the visibility of advanced care planning in the last several years. And part of that was when CMS decided to start actually compensating us for advanced care planning discussions that took 16 minutes or more with the 99497 and 99498 codes. But also, you know, within the healthcare community, there are great resources like Vital Talk and the Ariadne Project, and also in the larger lay population with efforts like the Conversation Project and Prepare for Your Care. So it's been sort of both prongs of that, I believe, have resulted in an improvement in patients communicating their wishes to the healthcare team and the healthcare system documenting and ultimately respecting those wishes. So we're a lot better than we were back in 1990, but we still have, I think, a long way to go. And also the increased visibility of palliative care services, not just in hospitals, but also in nursing homes and community-based palliative care, I think has also helped promote appropriate person-centered advanced care planning efforts. And, you know, I think there's little doubt that when patients and their families are given accurate information on their prognosis and on the effectiveness of various medical treatments and interventions, like CPR, let's say, in a typical long-term nursing home resident, oftentimes now people will elect not to request the default treatment, which is trying to prolong life at all costs. And then, you know, as far as the cost savings themselves, they are totally not the goal of these efforts. I think it is clear that sort of as a side benefit, decreased healthcare costs do occur when patients and families elect to go with comfort-focused treatment, which we see most commonly when people have a terminal condition or when their condition is not expected to improve. So I do think we've made good progress. And just as a nursing home doctor, it's one of the great privileges of my day-to-day work is getting to have these conversations with people. Sometimes they've never had it before, even though they just got out of the hospital, even though they've been seeing the same primary doc for 20 years, the same nephrologist for 10 years. You know, none of these people have talked about, you know, what's going to happen toward the end of the line, and it's super important.
In a recent issue of the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management by the American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, Dr. Laura Prater and others looked at age inequalities in advanced care planning and suggested that gaps in ACP communication were age-based. Actual documentation of advanced care planning conversations or incorporation of advanced directives in the healthcare record were decreased in patients over 70 years old. Now, you talked about the skilled nursing setting, and it seems to me that one value of the post-acute care setting as a locus of care for the older patient would be that it could be a sanctuary for ACP discussions. You know, the patients are no longer acute like they were in the hospital, and preface that by saying, I think the hospital is one of the worst places to have these conversations. Family or surrogates can be present, you know, at regular intervals. The opportunity for documentation of the medical record and the utility of the multidisciplinary team like social work can be facilitated. What do you think about the skilled nursing facility setting as a focal point of advanced care planning, and how could teams incorporate advanced care planning into skilled care today or better? And what would the barriers be otherwise? So how can I, and you know, as the main question, as a practitioner, have ACP conversations tomorrow?
Well, I have little doubt that you're not already having these conversations yourself. But you know, for our listeners, I hope any physician who is seeing nursing home residents is already taking the time to do it. And you know, if you're not comfortable with these conversations, there are a lot of good resources for it, and there are skills that can be learned. I certainly encourage you to look into taking a Vital Talk course. They've got an app and so on, and I think it can be very helpful for people for whom it's not intuitive, and especially newer physicians who may not have had a lot of experience with it. But I think from a larger standpoint, I believe, and I'm biased because I'm a nursing home doctor primarily. I make house calls and see patients in residential care also, but mostly nursing home. And I think it's the perfect place to have these discussions because, as you pointed out, the person's no longer in a crisis mode the way it is in the acute care hospital. You know, the issues have been dealt with to the point where the person's stable enough to transfer out to the SNF. And so there's more time to consider their overall condition, their prognosis, in a more reasoned and less sort of emotional, almost battlefield type setting after the dust has settled a little bit. And I do think, you know, nursing home personnel, historically, there hasn't been a lot of conversation about it. It's required under the federal regulations that you know, advanced care planning and essentially code status be discussed. And sometimes this gets left to people maybe that also do not have a lot of skill in it. And I encourage, you know, as a medical director of a nursing home, I have encouraged training on PULSED and training on advanced care planning. I give in services about how to communicate these things because it's a part of life. And people who come into the nursing home, they're not the picture of health. These are not, you know, healthy 40-year-olds. These are people who are not considered to be medically safe or appropriate to go home, either for medical reasons or rehab reasons. So this is a perfect time when there's a period of relative stability to sit down and talk about where they see things going. And, you know, we want to make sure that we give them care that's concordant with what they want. And so I think the team can help. So a social worker in the facility can help. Nurses in the facility can help. But I really believe it's the attending physician's job to do this. And I think that can be delegated if you've got good people around. But I don't know. To me, it's like a sacred trust with my patients. I mean, that's part of the most important thing that I can do is to take the time to figure out what they want, ensure that they understand what they're looking at medically, and then make decisions and then write orders that reflect those decisions.
You know, for patients that you might see in the skilled setting who on the outside have their own primary care doctor, have you gotten pushback from a primary care doctor, you know, regarding advanced care planning discussions or conclusions that came from these discussions where a provider would say, you know, I don't agree with that, or that's not what I'm going to do, or something along those lines?
Yeah. So I've been doing this work for like 25 years, and I can count on one hand the number of times that I've gotten any actual resistance from a community physician about these discussions. And generally it has been that they're not ready to be a DNR or something like that, but it's a rarity. And that's been of quite a few years since that last happened. I do occasionally see that a person's, you know, if we do a PULSED for them and they are, let's say, DNR selective treatment or what they call limited treatment in some states, that they wind up going back to the hospital with a full code PULSED or that form has disappeared. But that it's uncommon. And I think the community physicians, for the most part, are very grateful for the fact that we're having these conversations. And in my facilities, if we do a PULSED form, we will fax a copy of it to the primary physician's office so they have it on file. And they are generally really grateful about that. But you do bring up a point that I wanted to mention as far as a barrier. This is what you hear most often as far as, I mean, there's lots of excuses that doctors give for not doing this. You mentioned time, and you know, it's an uncomfortable conversation. And, oh, maybe it takes away hope because we're talking about death. Time might be a reasonable excuse, although as a nursing home doc, you don't have a waiting room full of people. So that's a great blessing, is to be able to take the time you need. But the thing you don't have that a community PCP would have is you don't have a longstanding relationship with these people. And I've really not found that to be a big barrier. Once in a while, people will say, well, my doctor never said that or that sort of thing. But for the most part, once they get over the shock that you're bringing it up, people are super grateful to have had the conversation. And they're super grateful to understand that when you check DNR on a PULSED form, that does not mean just stand there and watch me die gasping for breath. That means don't try to resuscitate me if my heart stops beating and I stop breathing. Very, very different things that the lay community often doesn't understand. And they also, I think, don't understand that CPR is extremely ineffective in a frail, elder, chronically ill population.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from Afoundria, the creators of ChartPath. Our world is changing, and the demands on your practice are growing. Nobody wants to just buy an EHR. You want a technology partner by your side. That's why they built ChartPath, a simple-to-manage and simple-to-use EHR backed by a dedicated team 24/7 that will guide your practice through MIPS and help you manage your growth. Most importantly, ChartPath is efficient, so you can continue to give your patients the high level of care you are known for and still make it home in time for dinner.
We're talking with Dr. Carl Steinberg about advanced care planning. Dr. Steinberg, I want to talk a little bit more about the documentation, as I find that this tends to be a real source of confusion across nearly every specialty, especially around goals of care and advanced directives. Terms are often used interchangeably or incorrectly, it seems to me. In the state of Massachusetts, for example, the only accepted advanced directive is the healthcare proxy. While other states have living wills or healthcare powers of attorney, orders for life-sustaining treatment, MOLST, you mentioned PULSE, do not seem to be the potential conclusions to ACP discussions, but rather a means to an end themselves. And they're often called advanced directives as well. Knowing that you could give a full day's lecture on this topic, and California was the first state to have a living will statute in the 1970s, can you at least give us a brief primer now on these documents, also knowing that you are an advocate for their use? How are these documents intended to help in patient care, and how do we need to be generating and using them correctly?
Yeah, that's a big question and a long answer, but I'll try to make it short. I think PULSE paradigm forms, and they have about 13 different names. We're currently trying to get a little bit more standardization around them, but you know, it's a national program, but it's, you know, state implementation. So, but I want to make it clear, PULSE paradigm forms, whatever you call them in your state, my favorite is TPOP. They are not advanced directives, right? They're orders. They're physician or nurse practitioner, PA orders. And there's a lot of confusion around them. So I think as clinicians, what we need to really help our patients with is that everybody, whether you're healthy or ill, young or old, everyone should have an advanced directive. Whatever it's called in your state, this is the document where you can make a general statement about, you know, how aggressively you might want to be treated. But the most important thing is that you are designating a proxy or a surrogate or an agent, whatever it's called in your state, to make decisions on your behalf if you become incapacitated. That's super important, and it's super important that you designate the right person, but that's a whole nother lecture. But basically, these documents are similar state to state, and they're usually not too onerous to fill out, although you can't necessarily get them all completed in a doctor's office. But everybody should be given these forms and instructed that it's important to designate somebody. So that's right off the bat. Now, PULSE used to be called physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. In other states, it's clinician orders or practitioner orders or whatever. But PULSE on a national basis is kind of stepping away from the acronym for two reasons. One is it's not just physicians who can write it. I mean, it's the orders are for the patient, right? They have to be signed by either a doctor or in some states, nurse practitioners and PAs. So that's part of the reason. And then the whole LST part of it, it sort of implies that you can give life-sustaining treatment. And let's face it, putting a feeding tube in a patient with advanced dementia has never been shown to be actually life-sustaining when you look at the evidence. Performing CPR on a 68-pound, 97-year-old has never been shown to sustain life, right? It's just may prolong the dying process slightly, but so there's that sort of implicit value judgment. But in any event, if you're a person, if your patient wants routine default treatment, which is, I want my life prolonged, within reasonable parameters, I want the most aggressive treatment, then you don't need a PULSE form to say that. Now, if you are in that small segment of the population who does want the most aggressive treatment at all costs, no matter what, and no matter how your condition changes and your prognosis, then you should fill out a PULSE form. And I would suggest writing in, I don't want anyone to change this. But a huge majority of people do not want that. And they really want a family member, if they're incapacitated, to make decisions based on what they think that patient would have wanted. So the PULSED form, PULSED paradigm forms, are for people nearing the end of life or those who have really strong feelings about what they do or don't want. But unfortunately, there are many nursing homes across the country who are using PULSED paradigm forms as basically as a code status document. And that's completely inappropriate. And I'll tell you, there's a number of reasons why, and I'd encourage you to go to the National PULSED website, which is just POLST.org. But some of the problems are that if somebody checks, yes, I want full code, full care, that is essentially going to create a conflict down the line when the person's condition changes, they've lost capacity, and then a family member, I mean, it creates conflict for the family, and it creates conflict for the healthcare team. Because guess what? This person, you know, when they were a lot healthier some years ago or months ago, they said, yes, I want you to try routine care. But now their condition has changed. And so you're basically doing something that looks like it's going against what they would want, but they're not there to tell you what they would want at that time. So I really encourage all of our listeners, do not be doing full code pulses on people who just want routine treatment.
Right. Right. Like the individual 50 years old who just had a total knee replacement and is in the skilled nursing facility for whatever reason, who for whom they asked, do you want everything done? Yes, I do. We'll sign this form. That's right.
Right.
That's
right. And of course, never ask it that way, right? But do you want everything done? Do you want us to do everything for your mom? Or, you know, do you want us to withdraw care, right? I mean, some of the language around this stuff is really, really value-laden, and it's unfortunate.
Communication is key. And I'll just point out that with regard to advanced directives, naming that surrogate, it is so important. We did a study of over 204,000 patients who were on our healthcare record and had received primary care in our institution, and found that 60% of age over 90 individuals did not have an advanced directive.
So, yes. Amen.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So, Dr. Steinberg, as has become customary in the time we have remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you, but not really. And, you know, we talked about the advanced care planning codes 99497 and 99498. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the future of ACP. You know, the codes have been available since 2016. They were intended to incentivize advanced care planning. Some reports indicate increased use of the codes. Other reports indicate more disappointing numbers. You know, the codes have not been without controversy. As well, as you're probably aware, there was a bill introduced in 2017 entitled Protecting Life Until Natural Death Act, which would in part have revoked the codes. Iowa Representative Steve King, who introduced the bill, said, allowing the federal government to marry its need to save dollars with the promotion of end-of-life counseling is not in the interests of millions of Americans who were promised life-sustaining care in their older years. Where are we today in this thinking? I no longer hear about death panels, but are there really opponents to advanced care planning out there who can change policy around what is generally considered to be today an important aspect of patient-centered care?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to try to not get too political here, but well,
it's hard for you to try.
Yeah, I mean, Steve King, let me just, I don't know if wackadoodle is a medical term or not, but he's very much what I would consider fringe on this. And, you know, he's brought up this legislation year after year, and it always gets shot down. You know, so even other conservative Republicans, I think for the most part, can see that people want to have these conversations with their providers. Nobody's taking away anything. Nobody's twisting people's arms to sign a DNR. If there are people like that out there, that's inappropriate. And using these codes, I mean, these codes do not incentivize a DNR status. They don't incentivize people filling out any particular form. None of that's required. It's just talking to people about the stuff they're already thinking about, right? They're 90 years old. Whether or not they've been quote unquote promised life-sustaining treatment, which is ridiculous. I mean, nobody's been promised. The only thing I can promise you is we're all going to die, right? So regardless of that, people really appreciate these conversations. Why on earth would you not want people to get care that is concordant with their wishes. So, you know, whack-a-doodle, that's what I say. And, you know, there is some resistance. There are some conservative Catholic bishops in the Midwest who sort of think that Pulsed in general shouldn't be done because it encourages people to not get the most aggressive treatment. You know, if you look at the Catholic teachings, they do not require that everybody's life be prolonged to the last possible instant. There's this principle of proportionality. There's no requirement, and this goes back quite a few popes, you know, that if treatments are overly burdensome, there's no requirement to request those treatments. And there's also the notion of medical futility, which we don't use that term much anymore. It's, you know, medically ineffective or medically non-beneficial treatment. But as healthcare providers, we're not obligated to provide treatment that we believe to be futile. So, I mean, that's a long roundabout answer to your question. But in my opinion, the acknowledgement, the recognition that these codes give to the importance of these conversations is excellent. I just cannot see, and we haven't seen much resistance to it, truthfully, beyond these bills that King keeps bringing up that have gone nowhere. So I think, is it possible that some people are using these codes inappropriately, or, you know, overbilling them and that sort of thing? It's certainly possible, just like it is with anything else. Personally, I have to tell you, it's not a common thing for me to bill this code because, truthfully, these conversations often don't take 16 minutes. Now, sometimes they take hours. Sometimes, you know, it's multiple long conversations around the bedside with patients and families. But a lot of people already have a pretty good idea of what they want. And so, you know, I bill the codes judiciously, but I'm very glad that I am able to bill them. And I appreciate CMS for acknowledging the importance of that part of our work.
Amen to that. We have been privileged to speak with and learn from, again, our society's own Dr. Carl Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg, thank you so much for spending more of your time with AMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne. A pleasure.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.